hear me? Is this good? Yeah? Okay. So thank you so much for organizing this wonderful event. I'm thrilled to be part of this, and I cannot have expected a better respondent because Irene is very expert in the topic of Michel Héris, and that will be at the end of my lecture. The German Jewish poet and critic Karl Einstein, one of the most ardent promoters of African art of the European interwar period, was fond of recounting a myth related to the origins of the mask. Originating from the Kasai region, present-day Democratic Republic of Congo, the story has it that Kashashi, wife of the Kuba king Samba Mikepe, went to the river one day to transport water to the village while being followed by her child. Since the presence of the child caused her to spill most of the water on her way, a solution had to be found. One day, Kashashi carved a mask out of her calabash, which she donned when her son tried to follow her out of the village. Frightened by the sight, the child cried, "This is not my mother, this is a frightful spirit," and returned quickly to the village. Given early 20th century Europeans' vague knowledge of African art and cultural traditions, this myth very likely impressed Einstein as one of the few indigenous sources pertaining directly to aesthetics. This is presumably why he recounted it in print no less than three times, first in Afrikanische Plastik, again as one of the 74 African folk tales he edited for the anthology Afrikanische Legenden from 1925, and lastly, in Mask Bapindi, a short article on African art that appeared in 1930 in the Parisian Review Document. In this last text, one finds Einstein's only commentary on the story. He considers it curious that, quote, "the invention of the mask should be attributed to a woman," unquote. A mind as rigorous as Einstein's, however, is unlikely to have missed the conspicuous tension between the Kuba myth and his own preconceptions of African masks. One recalls, for instance, the vivid phenomenology of African masquerade in Einstein's earliest and most well-known text on African art, namely Negre Plastic, from 1915. And I won't read the whole text out because you have the passage on the screen. I just point out the part where he discusses how the Negro transforms himself into the objective powers. And then here in the middle, he says, "This transformation offers him the most powerful comprehension of objectivity. He incarnates it with himself. He himself is this objectivity in which all individuality is annihilated. Consequently, the mask has meaning only when it is inhuman, impersonal, constructive," so on and so forth. And then the term, very famous, fixed ecstasy, to which he gives the mask. Symptomatic of the largely speculative character of Negre Plastik, which critics were very quick to point out as soon as the text appeared in 1915, this fantastical description indicates that Einstein was more of a thinker of the early 20th century European avant-garde than a scholar of African art. With little empirical basis, the ecstatic mask dance depicted here is characteristic of the forms of depersonalization imagined by the avant-garde as the means of undermining the individual subject, which according to this generation of nonconformist European thinkers have been accorded an undue degree of moral autonomy and unity of consciousness by Western post-Enlightenment humanism. If this critique of the European humanist subject was already a feature of literary and artistic modernism prior to the outbreak of the First World War, it was in the 1920s and 30s that it acquired an unparalleled intensity as Einstein, and above all, his colleagues in Paris-based surrealism, made the dismantling of the European anthropological machine, and this is the philosopher Giorgio Agamben's term, made the dismantling of the European anthropological machine an aesthetic, philosophical, and ethical imperative. The figure of the mask played a paramount role in this project, as could be glimpsed from this passage from Negre Plastik, but it was also ambiguous. Does the donning of the mask constitute the destruction of the individual subject, or rather its reconfiguration? The Kuba myth, after all, about the origin of the mask, tells a slightly different story than Negre Plastik. Whereas the ecstatic male masker in Negre Plastik loses his subjective ego in ecstatic religious worship, The cunning female protagonist of the Kuba myth does not as much lose as she doubles her subjectivity by means of an alter ego. Kashashi's calabash mask remains within the parameters of the everyday and the social, being a pragmatic solution that allows the queen to attend alternatively to the needs of the family and those of the village, so the child that follows her and the water she has to fetch. The mask in negroplastic, by contrast, signifies the departure from the human world and the entry into the inhuman, impersonal, an objective realm of the divine. The question raised by Einstein's accounts of the mask can serve as a theoretical point of departure for my remarks today. If Einstein had made the West African ceremonial mask the face of ecstasy in negroplastic, surrealism may be seen as deploying a wide variety of masks, veils, and like objects to serve as the faces of comparable states of passivity. Dream, childhood, hallucination, erotic love, trance, and madness. These modes of experience, ranging from prosaic to pathological, constitute what may be provisionally called the surrealist subject, which, as I will show presently, is represented by three types of mask that appear regularly in surrealist productions: the masquerade, the death mask, and the veil. This typology of mask has allowed surrealism to theorize a subject in terms of its vicissitude, negativity, and plurality. Yet, this anti-humanist enterprise of desubjectivization also stands to be critiqued in relation to the actual disintegration of the European civilization in the years leading to the outbreak of the Second World War. To that end, I will critique the surrealist theories of the subject from two radically distinct perspectives. One, the problem of anonymity as a condition of totalitarianism, as analyzed by the political philosopher Hannah Arendt. And two, the problem of what the post-colonial theorist Gayatri Spivak describes as the concealed subject. And here it's in quotation marks, and the subject's with very big S. By which Western radical criticism claims to dismantle the sovereign subject while actually inaugurating it. I will ultimately argue that a mask both conceals and exposes the subject of surrealism, whose over-identification with the primitive as antipode of the sovereign subject ends by reinforcing a new conception of the subject as mask. It is now commonplace to evoke the idea of the masquerade as a prototypical surrealist device. Already in Les Champs Magnétiques from 1920, the first surrealist text written using the technique of automatism, the poets André Breton and Philippe Soupault deploy the figure of the hermit crab as a mask for their now diffused authorial voice, titling two series of the poems The Hermit Crab Says. So in other words, the poetic voice comes out through the voice of the hermit crab, Le Pagure. As noted by Elsa Adamovic in a discussion of surrealist intertextuality, quote, the hermit crab colonizes empty shells, often after having devoured the mollusk inside, hosting in its turn other marine creatures. Similarly, in the surrealist intertextual strategies, the self appropriates the text of others, constructing an identity through the process of cannibalization. Insofar as the surrealists in 1920 were also participants of the Dada movement in Paris, this tactic may be seen as an extension of the travesty of the Dada stage. For the poets, in the midst of formulating the foundation of the surrealist movement, the most significant experience of the Dada stage is arguably that of speaking through masks, specifically those of inhuman beings, such as household objects. For Breton and Soupault in particular, it is indeed a short distance from speaking as the umbrella, the sewing machine, and the chamber rope in their absurdist Dada sketch, You Will Forget Me, the images are here, to taking up the hermit crab as the mask for the surrealist poetic voice. In the same Dada context, the use of makeshift costumes like the billboard and the tarp, here documented again by the photos from Festival Dada, has obvious affinities with the collage, where the artist does not as much invent as deck the work with ready-made forms. Thus, Max Ernst's 1920 collage would have parasitic sandworms dressed up in miniature images of women's hats cut from the milliner's catalog, masquerading as do the hermit crabs. Now here I think it's worth emphasizing the phonetic proximity between ascaride and mascarade, ascaride the worms and mascarade. Donning these hats as shoes, because one of the inscriptions, it actually says the sandworm is tying her sandals. In other words, by the vertical dropping of the hat from the head to the horizontal sand, they actually become shoes. Donning these hats as shoes, the parading sandworms become, quote, a caravan of extraordinary birds traversing a desert. And that is Aragon. While the Dadaist anti-humanist performance tactics had genuinely aimed to outrage the placid bourgeois audience, they ended up having a certain affinity with the activities and tastes of Parisian high society, which throughout the 1920s was discovering the chicness of the mask. After all, Paris Dada's increasing co-option by the mondain was one major reason for the defection of the movement's proto-surrealist faction. At the height of La Mode Negre, in part enabled by the art market's absorption of non-European tribal objects, African masks in particular became synonymous with fashionableness, so much that the Count Étienne de Beaumont could adopt an African theme for his Montparnasse costume balls, featuring masks with Grebo-inspired cylindrical eyes. In 1926, the magazine Vogue published Man Ray's classicizing photograph of the model Kiki's pearly face next to a ballet ebony mask. Here I'm showing you the reproduction in the Belgian review Variété, but this first appeared in 1926 in the American magazine Vogue. Where the racial difference between the white European and the black African is reduced to the elegant chromatic contrast between two similarly exquisite oval forms. In effect, the interwar vogue for the mask was sufficiently widespread that the Brussels-based cultural magazine Variété devoted to it several satirical photo essays between 1928 and 29. And here are some examples. I put many examples on the same slide, and here are more of them. With smug cheekiness, the juxtaposition of photographs in Variété intends to collapse the difference between the urbane and the folkloric, the European and the African, the artistic and the scientific, until all aspects of modern life, from the theater and the museum to the military and the clinic, appeared as one endless series of masquerade. In light of these contemporaneous and ultimately stereotypical practices of the Beaumont, what distinguishes the surrealist mask during the mature, which is to say the post-Dada phase of the movement, is its philosophical seriousness. Instead of a performance prop, the surrealist mask is the figure for a heteronymous and temporally contingent subject. Its rhetoric is neither Dada's nihilistic nothing, 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 nor high society's cool admission that all the world is a stage, but rather, who am I? The interrogative first line of Breton's Naja, the surrealist receipt from 1928. By Breton's estimation, the question can be answered only by finding out whom the speaker haunts, a word that makes me, quote, still alive, play a ghostly part, evidently referring to what I must have ceased to be in order to be who I am, unquote. In turning the eye into a ghost with its blind submission to certain contingencies of time and place, Breton inaugurates a fluid subject whose present identity is dependent on the displacement of a former one. Always already disappearing, this evanescent subject can be captured only as a trace, as in the mechanically generated photo booth pictures of the surrealists with eyes closed, with which René Magritte framed his painting La Femme Cachée in a 1929 photo collage. Virtual imprints of faces in the only state that could not be perceived by their owners in real time, these images resemble post-mortem photographs, with the difference that the photographic subjects could then open their eyes to behold their own petrified selves, which had only a moment ago ceased to be. There is a direct and obvious link between these photographs, virtual death masks as they were, and the actual mass the Bretons and Éloise had cast of themselves around 1930. Most likely made by the sculptor Paul Hamann and inspired by the famous cast of the head of an allegedly drowned young woman, which turns out to be actually a studio product and not a real death mask, the so-called Inconnus de la Seine, these fossils of the living reminded Breton of, quote, the secret of these precautions taken by nature to preserve for us certain vegetal or animal organisms of ancient epochs, a fern leaf, a shell, a small crustacean with marvelously spare antennas, unquote. With the surrealist death mask, the naked face is not as much concealed as in the hermit crab's masquerade, as it turns into a mask itself, thereby losing its long-held privilege in the European tradition as the epiphanic site of psychological interiority. The death mask is the petrification of the eye no longer, whereas the veil, the third predominant type of the surrealist mask, is the momentary concealment of the eye to be. The two types of mask, oriented respectively to the past and to the future, thus represent two diametrically opposed temporalities. That the veil is a figure of concealment, moreover, excludes the possibility that such future be determined teleologically in advance by the subject, as in the bourgeois Bildungsroman. With surrealism, the eventual revelation of the I to be is entirely conditioned by chance encounter. In Magritte's Lover, the veil is the interface where the man and a woman encounter one another as the unknown. Meanwhile, the ambiguity of the veil, specifically its simultaneous concealment and revelation of the face through the lurking contours behind the soft cloth, makes unveiling a constant possibility. That the unveiling of the subject for the future depends on objective chance is thematized by Man Ray's film the same period, Les Mystères du Château du Dé, from 1929, in which the veil appears in conjunction with the dice. To decide whether to travel, two veiled men, who are played by Man Ray and Boisfard, the photographer, cast dice in a Parisian bistro. The morning after their arrival at the chateau, they find two men and two women lying on their stomachs like children at play, likewise veiled, rolling two enormous dice on the floor. In this context, the veil functions much like the backside of a playing card in the game of divination. As suggested by Man Ray's photograph of Breton's L'Amour Fou, it is the still unknown face of the subject before being flipped over or unveiled by the anonymous hand of fate. The three types of masks thus far outlined are by no means mutually exclusive. In effect, their variations and interplay may be said to form the basis of surrealist practices and discourses throughout the 20s and 30s. The motif of the veil from Magritte, after all, is a kind of death mask insofar as it recapitulates the childhood memory of his mother's suicide by drowning, and her body was found with the head wrapped in the garment. So in a way, it is a death mask as well. During the movement's schism, the heterodox surrealist review document presents all three types, revised according to the sensibility and philosophy of Georges Bataille. Boisfard's photographs of grotesque carnival masks, the very far left, vulgarized the surrealist masquerade, whereas the photomontage of preserved skulls and severed heads, almost certainly orchestrated by Bataille, represents an effort to reinvent the surrealist death mask vis-à-vis the violent operation of the formless and the Gnostic-inspired idea of base materialism. By comparison, the occultist William Saybrook's sadomasochist leather mask, to which the writer Michel Eyrie devotes an eloquent essay, is a more interesting intensification of the surrealist veil. Black, hard, and tightened, the leather mask is the vigorous, if not virile, version of the white, soft, and loose veil. While it maintains the futurity of the surrealist veil, the anxiety it provokes now is oriented exclusively to the masculine erotic excitement rather than to the uncertainty of fate. In surrealism proper, one finds an intriguing case of the superimposition of the three types of mask in Breton's L'Amour Fou in 1937. As Breton recounts it, in the period when the sculptor Giacometti was working on Maintenant le Vide, the statue you see on the left, the two happened upon a metallic mask at the flea market, which they tried on as one would a carnival mask. This object, a military mask with a so-called Polak visor for protection against flying debris, I researched this, so you can actually buy these things from eBay now, becomes key for Giacometti's statue, whose unresolved face, Boton, not surprisingly described as veiled. Insofar as this mask, quote, seemed intended to help Giacometti overcome his indecision on the subject and manage eventually to lift the last veil on the young girl's face, it embodies the paradox of an unmasking mask. And I'll come back to this paradox at the end of this, my comments. The same object, moreover, turns out to be a sinister death mask, as Boton discovers through a letter from his friend Jean Bousquet. The sight of this object in a Belgian review had reminded Bousquet of the deadly Battle of Argonne, where he had to distribute such helmets to his troops, and where he saw many lives lost and received a bullet himself that paralyzed him permanently. The chance encounter with this artifact from the First World War is therefore the encounter between the past and the future. The fossil, preserving the ghosts of a bygone soldier, has somehow drawn the contour of a little girl whose face had yet to take shape. I now move to the critical section. Thanks in large part to postmodernist art writings, it has become possible, even commonplace now, to see surrealism and more broadly the early 20th century avant-garde as prefiguring certain radical practices and critical positions of the late 20th century. And no doubt one could say very much about the surrealist masquerade in relation to the disavowal of authorial originality, about the veil in terms of the denigration of vision or anti-vision, or about the death mask. One could discuss it in terms of the Freudian death drive and uncanny, and Freudian death drive and uncanny remade as features of a critical postmodernism. So here I'm quoting the work of Hal Foster, Rosalind Krauss, Yvan Lambois, so on and so forth, Martin Jay. In this postmodernist interpretation of surrealism, however, it is often assumed that select aspects of the movement, particularly those represented by peripheral figures like Bataille and Roger Caillois, have successfully formulated a critique of the crisis of the sovereign subject that does not, here I quote, does not revert to liberal humanism or romantic anti-capitalism. In the words of Hal Foster, quote, surrealism does not reject the becoming machine and or commodity of the body in reactive nostalgia for a natural man. Often surrealism resists it in dialectical wit with its own psychic effects, its own psychic damage, unquote. What this piously anti-humanist reading of surrealism forecloses are two possibilities that I here want to open. First, given that the surrealist mask as an aesthetic device, poetic, pictorial, plastic, dramatic, cinematic, etc., proliferated throughout the 1920s and 30s, that is, in the same period as Europe saw the organization of the masses and eventually the rise of totalitarian regimes, one is warranted to interrogate the relationship between the avant-garde's fascination with forms of depersonalization and the withering of individual, social, and class identities under totalitarianism. To what extent does surrealism's incessant defacement of the subject vis-à-vis the mask, not least its adoption of passivity as a mandate, constitute a tacit assent to anonymity, even a delirious abdication of agency, in the very moment when the latter is most endangered? Secondly, critical postmodernism does not admit the possibility that surrealism might have failed, at least to some degree, its own anti-humanist project. To return to an issue already raised in the beginning, it remains to be seen if the movement's persistent thematization of the mask and adoption thereof as a device constitute effectively the destruction of the individual subject, or if such practices rather reconfigure the subject, both its structure and the conditions that make possible its appearance. To address these questions, I want to now mobilize two radically different, even diametrically opposed theoretical perspectives that nevertheless meet in their trenchant critique of a tradition inaugurated by the avant-garde. In her study of the origins of totalitarianism in the 20th century, the political philosopher Hannah Arendt includes an intriguing chapter on the uneasy affinities between the elite, the mob, and the masses in Western modernity. She refers in particular to the disturbing ways in which the activist dimension of totalitarianism and its complete disregard for respectability appealed, here I quote Arendt, the anti-humanist, anti-liberal, anti-individualist, and anti-cultural instincts of the front generation, which is exactly the same generation that we're dealing with here in the exhibition and in my talk, whose members, quote again, shared with Lawrence of Arabia the yearning for losing themselves and the violent disgust with all existing standards, unquote. While this genuine desire for de-individuation distinguished the European intelligentsia after the First World War from the mob, which is not to be confused with the people, the mob was susceptible to bourgeois genius idolatry, but the avant-garde was not. By Arendt's estimation, the same set of anti-bourgeois instincts came dangerously close to the peculiar selflessness of the mass man, which, I quote again, appeared under totalitarianism as a yearning for anonymity, for being just a number and functioning only as a cog for every transformation which will wipe out the spurious identifications with specific types of or predetermined functions within society, unquote. Although this instinct turned out to be politically inconsequential, the avant-garde's yearning for anonymity and proximity of its mentality to that of the masses are for Arendt indicative, quote, of the European elite's lack of a sense of a reality. Now, it will be easy enough to argue with Arendt's indictment, given the heterogeneous character of the avant-garde. Obviously, not all movements and figures will fit her description. For a theoretical standpoint, however, what is more interesting to me is the rather surprising ways in which Arendt's charge resonates with the more recent criticism of post-colonial theorist Gayatri Spivak, who takes post-war Western intellectuals to task for their presumptuous over-identification with the world's masses. In the opening of her now classic essay, Can the Subaltern Speak?, Spivak implicitly attributes this impulse to what Arendt had described earlier as the elite mob alliance in European modernity. Spivak points to the example of the poet Charles Baudelaire, whose vicarious identification with the spirit of pure revolt among those Marx calls the conspirateurs de profession, which is exactly Arendt's mob, has been critiqued by the critic Walt Benjamin. More problematically for Spivak, late 20th century philosophers like Michel Foucault and Gilles Deleuze specifically, as inheritors of this radical tradition, licensed themselves to speak in the name of select, quote, monolithic and anonymous subjects in revolution, all the while proclaiming to undertake a critique of the sovereign subject. For Spivak, who finds these gestures of the radicalized Western intelligentsia more hypocritical than misguided, the, quote, much publicized critique of the sovereign subject actually inaugurates a subject, unquote. And if this concealed subject pretends it has no geopolitical determinations, one task of post-colonial criticism is to unmask its facade of neutrality, to expose the devious ways in which it, now I quote again, it fills the empty place of the agent with the historical son of theory, the subject of Europe, the subject, very big S, once again. Surrealism, a preeminent representative of the interwar avant-garde that Arendt criticizes, and a precursor of Western radical criticism under Spivak's scrutiny, cannot but be liable to this mode of critique, which may be formulated as follows. Notwithstanding its identification with anonymity and aspiration to selflessness, this is Arendt's term, surrealism ultimately does not as much dismantle the sovereign humanist subject as it fills the empty place of the agent with the subject of surrealism. If the subject is principally male, white, European, metropolitan, and bourgeois, at least from the outside of the movement, it has always donned and spoken through the mask of the primitive, conceived in the expansive sense. The schizophrenic, the women, the child, the tribes person, the peasant, and other figures to whom the subject of surrealism attributes a privileged access to states of alterity. These figures of the primitive are speculative, ersatz subjects for surrealism, yet in two ways they differ from the subjects in revolution with whom post-war Western intellectuals are fond of allying. And here are my only revisions of Spivak's thinking. One, they are heterogeneous rather than monolithic. And two, they're not anonymous, but representing, if not performing, in the sense that they are not without their own mask. That is to say, the various permutations of the primitives are as much masks for the rhetorically normative subject of surrealism as much as they are maskers themselves. In the remaining time, I want to suggest that this paradox undercuts surrealism's project of dehumanization while simultaneously presenting an opportunity for subjectivity to be radically reconceived. I will thus give two examples that illustrate this paradox, whereby the subject of surrealism identifies itself with a figure of alterity who turns out to speak through its own mask or masks. The first example precedes the official founding of the movement by more than 6 years and had remained since then an instructive template. In 1918, in a prose poem for the review Nord-Sud, titled Subject, the young Breton attempts to simulate the ramblings of a patient from the neuropsychiatric ward of Saint-Dizier, where he himself had served as a neurological intern during the First World War. Informed by the actual speech of the patient, a madman who did not believe in the war, the text prefigures surrealism's intertextual masquerade, where the philosophical and clinical subject in question, and here, you know, the text itself is titled sujet subject, but of course it's a double meaning, a philosophical subject and also a clinical subject. No doubt Breton wanted the term to refer to both contexts. The philosophical and clinical subject here served as Breton's authorial mask. Yet this subject turns out to wear a mask of his own, in the sense that he sees himself as playing a role or acting in a massive theater that is the war. As Breton's text indicates, this belief that all evidence of the war are mere effects of staging, from the official notices and the farewells in the train stations, to the artillery fire and the wounded and the dead bodies on the battlefield, all of this was merely theater for this man that Breton had met. This belief allows the subject or the narrator to claim a delirious degree of agency, which Breton simulates in the first person. I practically give away the spectacle of my exemplary bravery. I make a game of showing up the deception for what it is. And finally, the subject boasts of an incident that first alerted his superiors to his condition. And here he recounts, "This August 21st, during an unprecedented bombardment, I intentionally exposed myself on the open terrain, conducting the passing shells with my finger. And how charming the torpedoes were. I brushed them aside. They refreshed the air. With such artifice, they have so far held me in the grip of the sublime, although the apparatus of death did not impress me the way they believed. I stepped over some corpses, it's true. They furnished the dissection rooms with them. A good many more might have been made of wax. Most of the wounded appeared quite content. As for the illusion of spilled blood, it has a part to play even in the provinces, thanks to theatrical works of Monsieur Dumas. And don't bandages conceal all their indiscretions?" As noted by Marguerite Bonnet, the fact that Breton has the narrator bend the facts of reality to fit his interpretation indicates that the author is familiar with the mechanisms of paranoia. Still more significant is Breton's attention to the theatrical dimension of the condition. Rather than repressing his delirium as a neurosis, the paranoiac acts it out as if it were a mask, speaking his lines, as Paul Valéry has noted, for an audience that's neither someone nor himself. A decade and a half later, the artist and theorist Salvador Dali takes up this theater of paranoia explicitly when theorizing a new image-making method he calls critical paranoia. Informed by Jacques Lacan's empirical research on paranoia psychosis, Dali imagines a paranoia subject that revises the passive subject of automatism. The former does not as much harbor as he dons his delirium. Actively defying reality, the paranoiac subject is not only an agent, but more precisely an actor. The paranoiac images haunting him constitute a mask that he performs in a world now transformed into his stage. So here, of course, for Dali, the paranoiac images, it's very personal, is the are images, Angelus of the Gleaners by the 19th century realist painter Jean-François Millet. And you can see now he's wearing this delirium as if it were a mask, because it's not no longer just an internal vision. Following this reading, the claim to passivity and forms of depersonalization on the part of the subject of surrealism is undercut from the outset by the survival of a subject as an actor. It comes thus as no surprise that the movement would eventually acknowledge what had been there all along, the paradox of a depersonalized, yet still active and intentional subject. In Paranoia, the figure of alterity with which the subject of surrealism identifies becomes a subject, insofar as subjectivity is understood contingently as the actor revealed rather than concealed by its mask. And so here I return to this theme of the mask that actually unmasks instead of conceals. In my second example, which deals not with paranoia but with possession, it is the encounter with this actor, more precisely actress, if not actresses, that dispossesses the subject of surrealism of the very alterity it wishes to claim. In 1932, in his capacity as archivist for the colonial mission Dhaka Djibouti across Africa, the former surrealist Michel Léris undertook ethnographic research on a cult of possession in Gondar, Ethiopia, known as Zaar. Seeing professional ethnography as an alternative to moribund literature, Léris sought to shed his European self and its, quote, mediocre little white manners. This desire to get out of my skin and approach the skin of others predisposed the white male and metropolitan ethnographer to be fascinated with the predominantly female and illiterate devotees of the Zaar cults who practiced trance and claimed to be possessed by invisible mythic beings known as Zaars. The ethnography carried out over 5 months, however, eventually obliged Léris to recognize the theatrical dimension of Zaar possession. The theatrics of Zaar do not negate the reality of the trans experience, whose physiological dimension Léris duly records in his academic articles on the subject. Quote, the testimonies are consistent in that the possessed does not lose her consciousness all at once, but rather effaces herself gradually, quivering, tingling, shooting pains, trembling, hiccups, buzzing in the ears, generally sensation of heaviness and anguish are the signs announcing the trance, unquote. However, a number of facts suggest that Zaar possession is also an art form. The newly initiated are trained to perform trance movements corresponding to specific Zaars. In other words, they don't just automatically know what to do with their bodies and their movements and their footsteps. And the specific dance is known as the guri. And here you have examples of the chief shaman, Malcolm Ayehu, and one of her devotees, an adept, doing this kind of guri. The experienced adepts, when possessed, sing Zaar songs and recite poems belonging to particular figures. The chief priestess keeps a wardrobe containing accessories of major Zaars to be donned on high feast days. The adepts evaluate one another's trance in terms of degree of authenticity. Léris thus came slowly to consider the Zaar a virtual mask and the Balazars, or the possessed, as unacknowledged actresses among whom the chief priestess, Malcolm Ayehu, is the virtuoso. Like the paranoiac subject in the first example, the possessed subject enacts its subjectivity with the difference that her performance is anchored in the social. In the case of the priestess Malcolm Ayehu, the large number of Zaars whose gestures and songs she performs frequently appear in connection to her professional duties as healer, arbiter, and ritual celebrant. Thus, she incarnates the virile military Zaar, Abba Koskos, when settling disputes, breaking up rowdy parties, or remodeling houses, but conveniently becomes Shankit, the compliant maidservant, when serving food and drinks at Zaar festivals. Léris notes, for each activity of her life, including the various medical practices, she has a specific Zaar corresponding to that activity. Her Zaars constitute for her a kind of wardrobe of personalities that she could put on according to the various needs and hazards of her daily existence. Personalities that provided her with ready-made comportments and attitudes on the threshold between theater and life. Unquote. To borrow from Einstein, whose Africa-related text had helped set the terms of these remarks, Malcolm Ayehu is at once the ecstatic masker of negroplastic, adept at annihilating her individuality in trance, and the queen Kashashi of the Kuba myth, whose mask enables her to perform different and irreconcilable social roles. As a final remark, I want to briefly return to the surrealist paradox of the unmasking mask. Just as the encounter with a metallic mask at the flea market ends up unveiling the face of Giacometti's nascent statue in Botton's L'Amour Fou, The discovery of the czars as masks unveils the subjectivity of the subaltern in Lyrisse's ethnography. Having projected upon the possession of rural East African women the mirror image of his own self-dispossession, the metropolitan European ethnographer now finds this image shattered, its place overtaken by hundreds of masks. On October 31, 1932, Lyrisse recounts his disenchantment in his semi-ethnographic, semi-autobiographical diary for the mission, the sprawling text that we know later as L'Afrique Fantôme. Having recognized czar as a form of vernacular theater, Lyrisse notes, "Maka Mayehu and her family started to annoy me. I am less and less able to see Magi and Atreide in these peasants. Emma Waish, who is the chief czarine's daughter, and her mother do not dazzle me anymore," unquote. In short, the mythic primitives have become unbearably human. Having looked for a utopian degree zero of subjectivity in possession, the European ethnographer finds instead an excess of subjects in the virtuosic shaman. Like the Ancien Régime painter Antoine Coipel's fictional barbarian, who finds it strange that several different masks should be laid out for the same dancer, Lyrisse could not but conclude from Malcolm Ayehu's artful alternation between czar masks that there must be several souls in a single body, unquote. As they have done since the beginning, these souls, or subjects in hiding as I would like to see them, in the subaltern thwart the project of desubjectivization on the part of the concealed subject of surrealism. The persistence of masks means the persistence of subjects. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments directly to Joyce Schenk?